Hello, on this week's programme, a conversation with Fiach McCungall, Artistic Director of the Abbey Theatre, the National Theatre of Ireland. That company's production of Marco Rowe's Terminus opens at the Annenberg Centre for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia on Wednesday. David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to a couple of rather unusual concerts that Michael Tilson Thomas will conduct, narrate, sing and dance in with the Philadelphia Orchestra. And Tom Keels looks at efforts to secure a future for the venerable ocean liner, the SS United States. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Irish relationship with the English language is as complicated as that of the Irish people with their former imperial masters. Prior to the potato blight of 1845 to 1852 that caused millions to die of starvation or flee, the main language of the Irish people was Gaeilge, Gaelic, the Irish language, or today simply Irish, which is closer to Romance languages like Spanish and Italian than those of Germanic origin like English and Dutch. British government policy in Ireland from the 17th century onwards made it economically and socially beneficial to speak English, and after the Great Hunger, not famine, Ireland was a net exporter of food during the 1840s and 50s, the Irish language went into serious decline, to be eventually superseded by English. But not English as spoken in England. This Anglo-Irish dialect is much in evidence in the work of writers from W.B. Yeats to James Joyce to Oscar Wilde, and more recently Frank McCourt and Roddy Doyle. Yet it is in theatrical literature that English as spoken in Ireland has had its biggest stage. The plays of John Millington Synge, notably the Playboy of the Western World, Sean O'Casey's The Plough and the Stars, and Brian Friel's Dancing at Lunasa and Philadelphia Here I Come are all written in the Anglo-Irish style. The plays of these and many other influential Irish writers have also in common the fact that they were premiered on the stage of the Abbey Theatre, Ireland's national theatre. Founded in 1904 by Yeats, Synge and fellow playwright Isabella Augusta, Lady Gregory, the Abbey was the first state-supported theatre in the English-speaking world, and for more than a century has been the epicentre of Irish theatre. Its mission is, and always has been, to support the creation of works that incorporate the vernacular of the age and express Irish social and political concerns. In the past decade, the Abbey has gone through some significant changes. By its centenary in 2004, the theatre was commissioning very little new work, audience numbers were dwindling, and it was deep in debt. A multi-million-dollar deficit forced the departure of Artistic Director Ben Barnes, who was replaced by Fiach McCungall. Since his appointment, McCungall has managed to clear the deficit and get the Abbey back to what he considers its core function, to bring new and exciting work by Irish playwrights to the stage. Beginning Wednesday, one of the first plays commissioned by McCungall, Terminus by Marco Rowe, begins a six-show run at the Annenberg Centre for the Performing Arts in West Philadelphia. When I met with Fiach McCungall, I first asked him to describe what he feels is the special relationship the Irish have with the English language.
We're a community that depended much on the oral tradition. Okay, and that oral tradition is centuries old. The idea of telling a story, transmitting that story to the next generation, whether it's a song, a poem. It's also important that the poet was a very, very important part of every ancient Irish tribe and Irish community. A poet would celebrate a great success by a chieftain or a great travesty or a great disaster and would write a poem about that. So poetry, literature, writing is really an elemental part of what we are as a community. Without that, there is no such thing as an Irish psyche, an Irish mind, or indeed an Irish community. And that's developed and developed. And I think what happened in the earlier part of the 20th century was that all these writers came together and felt, you know what, our lives and our traditions aren't seen on our stages. So that's why W.B. Yeats and Gregory and Synge came together and said, you know, it's our job to make sure that our citizens see what we're about on our stages and not some other work perhaps from England or Europe that actually had no regard for that. And that's what our bottom line is. All our writers, whether it's Marco Rowe or whether it's W.B. Yeats, write about the here and now and communicate that to their citizens. And it's become very much a part of that. Now, the second reason why perhaps we're so successful, we've kind of colonised the English language, you know. For many, many years, Irish was our language and English was forced on us. But what we did and what James Joyce did and what Synge did was, hang on a minute, yeah, that's a language, but we're going to colonise that. We're going to use it in our way and use the musicality of the Irish language, put it into the English, and ba-boom, that's what we have. And I think those are some of the reasons why we're quite successful.
The subject matter of most new work that appears at the Abbey generally looks at Ireland or the Irish condition. Is that a rule or is it a tradition or is it just a coincidence?
Well, no, I mean, we're a national theatre, okay, so we're not like any other theatre. So our job is to reflect and engage Irish society. That's what I have to wake up every morning thinking, okay, you know, so the promise I make to the citizen or the visitor is if they come to the Abbey for a whole year, they should get a sense of what people are talking about. They should get a sense of what the world is about. They should get a sense of, you know, what the big issues of the day is. So I sit down and when I program, I look both at a classical work like Shakespeare or our own Irish repertoire and then try and mix that with some of the Irish work. So we're dependent. I mean, without sounding in any way too esoteric, our artists are our prophets, right? And a lot of our artists write about something that perhaps we haven't even kind of considered yet, you know. When you look at the great play that Brian Frail wrote, Philadelphia, Here I Come, which was the first time that a writer ever used two actors for one part, Gar Private and Gar Public. The idea of the split imagination, the inner voice, the outer voice, and how that works. So we actually do depend on our artists and our writers to kind of tell us what's happening, tell us how we feel, how anxious we are. And so if you mix that with the repertoire work, where you can actually be directly political, if we say whether Shakespeare or O'Casey, then the job of the National Theatre, the Abbey Theatre, is to present all that in one seamless programme and, of course, to highly entertain people as well. I mean, you know, it is a bit of fun to come and see a lot of our shows as well.
I'm guessing, though, that some of the programming challenges must be that if you put on Waiting for Godot, you're going to, I guess, sell it out, particularly if you do it in the summer. The same with Philadelphia, Here I Come, with what would be the standard rep for Irish theatre. How necessary is it to keep reminding people of the legacy and how important is it that you avoid the temptation to continuously just keep reminding people how great we were?
I mean, ideally, I want the theatre full every night. But of course, what happens is, you know, when you present new work, when you present work that's not known, it's not as well supported. But that's our job. So what I have to do is, through state funding, through private funding, and through good mix of pragmatic programming, the successful play will pay for new work. And some of the new work that we do might not attract a large audience, but that's our job. That is our mission. And for us to do that, because the next Brian Friel will come out of that, the next Tom Murphy, the next Sean O'Casey will come out of that. And so it's very, very important for us to do work that doesn't attract huge audiences, so that actually we begin to develop them, support them, and build them up, so that actually, because we have two theatres, we have a small studio space called the Peacock, which is 140 seats, and then we have a large space, which is 500 seats. So I can see work going from the Peacock stage to the Abbey stage, you know, and therefore, like, a successful production. Like, we have a very successful production just finishing called John Gabriel Borkman, which is going to New York in January. However, that's going to pay for a young writer's production in the Peacock. So it's about codependency between the two stages. And having a show that doesn't have a huge audience can be just as successful on a critical basis. And that's how I plan the year.
And all great plays were once new plays.
That's right.
Tell us about the evolution of Terminus. When did it first come to your attention? You were there, I guess, at the genesis.
I was. I took over in 2005, and one of the first phone calls I made was to Mark O'Rourke, who's a colleague and a friend, said, Mark, I need you. The Abbey needs you. We need your next play. And he accepted that challenge.
So why did you need him?
I need him because when I took over in 2005, the Abbey was not exactly in great shape. It was deep in deficit. It was about $5 million in deficit and had very little new commissioned work. So I was appointed in May 2005 to regenerate the Abbey, to revitalise it, to change it around, to change the way it works, you know. There wasn't a full-time literary department at the time, very little work commissioned. And so I essentially started to rebuild the Abbey and rework it. And that's why I had to call Mark, because I depended on him, because I think he's a great writer. I think he's a really important writer. And he's a writer that's not commercial in the sense that the other writers...
Well, I was just going to say, because if you're trying to recover a $5 million deficit, yeah. Probably going to a row is not going to help that, is it?
No, and but he will help replenish the soul of the Abbey. I'm a good producer. We turned around the deficit in 2 years, and we're now completely solvent and doing very well, and with a huge success. But you need the soul, and the soul are writers like Mark O'Rourke and Marina Carr, and our younger writers, Nancy Harris and Stacey Gregg. So you need that. And so Mark wrote the play, and we premiered it in 2007.
But back up, when he brings it into you and you look at it, what's your reaction?
Well, what we did was, I read it and it was extraordinary. It was extraordinary. And I tell you why it was extraordinary, because I started reading it and I had to read it aloud because it's in verse. This is a great storyteller in the old Irish tradition. It's a great story. Now, I've seen people cry and laugh and shout when they saw Terminus because they're hearing a story, some of it very graphic, some of it very funny, but it's all about language. It's all about this, and it's all in verse. And this is a man from Dublin, from Talla, who didn't have any third level education, but extraordinary artist who just decided to write something in verse. So when I sat down and read it, I went, this is amazing. First of all, I was forced to read it aloud because, when you read it, something on paper, you go, but actually when you read it, you go, and it's in rap. It's in traditional verse, it's in iambic pentameter, in a way, it goes right back to Yeats, because Yeats wrote verse plays. But this is the 21st century version of what a verse play is, and to use the phrase, it blows my mind, you know. So when I read it, I went, I've got to do this.
Abbey Theatre Artistic Director Fiach McCungall. Beginning Wednesday, the Abbey Theatre production of Marco Rose Terminus is at the Annenberg Centre for the Performing Arts in West Philadelphia.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Not many people wake up one day and realize that their grandparents were rock stars, or at least a previous generation's version of that. So it was with conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, the longtime music director of the San Francisco Symphony and the New World Symphony, whose original family name was Tomaszewski, as in Boris and Bessie Tomaszewski, who for decades were the charismatic golden couple of the Yiddish theater, based in New York and playing up and down the East Coast, including Philadelphia. On Tuesday and Wednesday with the Philadelphia Orchestra, both Tilson Thomas and the Tomaszewskis return in a special concert in which the conductor not only tells their story in words, photos and music, but as the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports, does a bit of singing and dancing himself.
Michael Tilson Thomas would be expected to be playing Franz Schubert, his latest musical obsession, as he is this week with the Philadelphia Orchestra. He always seems to be in a state of high discovery over something. But now another side has emerged, one that many never guessed at. He's the descendant of Yiddish theater royalty whose careers, roughly from the 1880s through the 1930s, would rival any picaresque novel. Tilson Thomas's Ukraine-born grandfather, Boris Tomaszewski, began his theater career as a newly emigrated teenager in Manhattan's Lower East Side, impersonating female divas when the real ones got sick. After his voice broke, he produced hit after hit after hit with his wife and co-star Bessie Tomaszewski. Sometimes they arrived at the theater not knowing what play they were doing that night. It was seat-of-the-pants stuff. Sometimes the orchestra was just instructed to, quote, fake something charming until Mrs. T gets off stage. Even their problems fascinated the public. Bessie was once arrested by none other than Teddy Roosevelt for defying New York's blue laws by performing on Sundays. Boris had trysts with female fans in the partial view theater boxes when not on stage, delivering what he called his improved Yiddish version of Hamlet. Even their divorce was monumental. Michael Tilson Thomas has described them as the Liz and Dick of their times.
When they had split up to refinance their separate empires, they each accepted contracts to write basically dueling autobiographies, which were initially serialized in a newspaper so that in the morning paper you could read Boris's version of the story, and in the afternoon you could read my grandmother's version of the story, albeit very often conflicting ones.
You could also compare that existence to a real-life version of the Marx Brothers, who in fact were veterans of the Jewish theater movement. In his research, Tilson Thomas discovered that his grandparents didn't exaggerate much and sometimes even toned down their accounts of their lives. The most startling discovery was that Boris Tomaszewski did a Yiddish version of Wagner's most sublime opera, Parsifal, long before that anti-Semitic composer became a Nazi poster boy.
Boris had actually put together a sort of pantomime with a bit of dialogue and had gotten the orchestra of the Metropolitan Opera to play a few performances of some extensive bits of Parsifal, and he created some kind of a show that went with that. You know, what that would have been, I have not the slightest idea. But in later years, when I met Friedland Wagner, when I told her that Boris had done a Yiddish version of Parsifal, she thought that was hilarious. She couldn't wait to tell Winifred and all the other card-carrying Wagners.
Thomas always knew his family had a glamorous past. How could he not when the name Tomaszewski is incorporated into popular songs, including one by George Gershwin?
Down with books by Dostoevsky. Down with Boris Tomaszewski.
But growing up in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles, where his father was a movie scriptwriter, Tilson Thomas was basically living in the country. His childhood visits to New York City were an eye-opener.
I went into town to visit a cousin of mine who was a stage manager, Georgie Zorn, real old, one of those, you know, crusty guys with a twinkle, sort of. And usually we'd go see a lot of different shows because he could get in backstage anywhere. So he'd say, oh, you want to see Pajama Game? Oh, the good scene is Foy's monologue, Act Two. We'll stand in the wings. We'll see that. The Lunts are still on this thing. It's still running. They're a mess, but it's still worth seeing. And, you know, that's what we do, jump around from show to show. But I wanted to see My Fair Lady. I said, oh, you want to see that? You want to see the whole thing? Okay, fine. We went over. It was a matinee. People were lined up for blocks, it seemed. He rapped on a door, and some guy came out, company manager, and he said, oh, Georgie, yeah, is he? Blah, blah. He said, he pointed to me and said, see this kid? Boris Tomaszewski's grandson. 2 seconds later, we were row five, and that's the first time I had a sense of, you know, what my grandfather had been, what kind of a presence he had been.
Michael Tilson Thomas's father, who shortened his name in order to make his own reputation in the entertainment world, sometimes considered putting together a Tomaszewski evening. He never did. And when Michael did, he discovered what his grandmother Bessie meant when she said her performances had a passion that was only possible because the raw material was there.
It's not really in the show, but it was not all so easy what they went through. I mean, they took enormous risks and kind of rewrote the rule book, and then they had to kind of deal with the consequences of that. My grandmother's remark about raw material, well, she meant that it's everything. Some of the raw material is not joyful. Some of it is painful.
The Boris-Bessie breakup was terrible. Bessie read in the newspaper that Boris's new girlfriend was getting a lion's share of the starring roles in her husband's plays. She walked out, had a successful career on her own, but he went into decline. His Broadway debut was a fiasco. He walked out on stage and simply couldn't speak. But as shown by a film appearance he made a few years before his death, he still had compelling moments. According to Boris Tomaszewski's New York Times obituary in 1939, he was still working shortly before his death, but under humbler circumstances on Coney Island, where he revived his play, The Green Millionaire. He died in debt, roughly $9,000, a big sum in those days. And somehow, said the New York Times, Bessie made it to Boris's bedside.
No kidding, I didn't know that.
Even though Tilson Thomas has always had a theatricality about him, and decades ago he was offered a role in the film Close Encounters of the Third Kind, he was not encouraged by his parents to go into theater or movies. Classical music seemed much more wholesome and more fully occupied his considerable intelligence, his analytic powers, as well as his prowess at the piano. But when assembling his Tomaszewski show, Tilson Thomas saw a point near the end of Act Two where something different needed to happen. Another voice needed to be heard, another body needed to dance. By default, those duties fell to him. Only when pressed did Michael Tilson Thomas say how it felt.
It was disturbingly easy to do. Underneath all of your education and, you know, sophistication is something as primal as that. Get out on stage and belt it out there somehow.
My sister was an actor, a real-life Yiddish actor. She saw him act and said, oi! I'm for you. Who do you suppose went and married my sister? Don't you know? Give a guess. Tomaszewski. I know if I told you it would knock you a twister. That's a dandy name to hang up in a frame. Well, my father said an actor ain't no business know-how. But Shevsky's got a bankroll big enough to choke a cow. Who do you suppose went and married my sister? Don't you know? Give a guess. Tomaszewski.
Don't worry, the Tomaszewski Show isn't a new Michael Tilson Thomas career path. Once the Tomaszewski Show is taped for PBS later this year, and now that he's opened a spectacular new concert hall for his new World Symphony in Florida, Tilson Thomas will take his composing life off hold. And to judge from this brass quintet titled Street Song that comes out next month on the Harmonia Mundi label, this apple fell pretty far from the tree. Still, the Tomaszewskis are an important chapter in cultural history that needed to be explored before its remnants disappeared. The Yiddish theater is one of those invisible but pervasive pop culture entities. The combination of mainstream entertainment with a strong undercurrent of social commentary made shows like South Pacific and West Side Story possible, says Thomas. George Gershwin and Irving Berlin had their foundations in the Yiddish theater world. Some of the songs were repurposed so convincingly we don't hear their roots. And without the popularization of the Yiddish language in the Jewish theater, where would our perception of human nature be without words like schnorr, schlemiel, schmuck?
The Philadelphia Inquirer is David Patrick Stearns. Michael Tilson Thomas conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra this evening in a program that includes works by Schubert, Bernstein, and Beethoven. On Tuesday at 8 and Wednesday at 7, he'll conduct the ensemble and sing, dance, and narrate the Tomaszewski's Music and Memories of a Life in the Yiddish Theater. All performances are at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall. Shoppers at IKEA in South Philadelphia often gaze in wonder at the giant ship moored on the Delaware River across Columbus Boulevard from the giant Swedish furniture store. The derelict vessel sits amidst rusting warehouses like some sort of abandoned set for the movie Titanic. This is the SS United States, a luxury liner that ruled the Atlantic Ocean before mass air travel. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores the legend behind this ghost ship and one group's efforts to try to bring it back to life.
When she was launched in 1952, the SS United States was the speediest, most powerful ocean liner ever built. The Big U carried nearly every celebrity of the 1950s across the Atlantic, including Grace Kelly and Prince Rainier, Dwight and Mamie Eisenhower, and the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. Although the SS United States sailed out of New York City, it was the brainchild of a Philadelphia-born engineer.
My grandfather, William Francis Gibbs, was the naval architect and marine engineer that designed the vessel.
Susan Gibbs is the president of the SS United States Conservancy.
He saw a ship launched on the Delaware River at the Cramp Yard, and, you know, this was when he was just a little boy, and the St. Louis it was, and just was so taken by this big ship launch that he later professed that he dedicated his life to ships at that moment. But then, you know, subsequently, beginning in 1914, he had a fantasy of designing the fastest ship in the world.
During World War II, Gibbs ran one of the country's largest shipbuilders, responsible for constructing over 75% of the American military vessels that saw service. After the war ended, he used his technical skills and official contacts to realize his dream of building the world's fastest ship. The SS United States was heavily subsidized by the American government, which had an ulterior motive for her construction.
It was not simply a luxury ocean liner, although it was certainly that. It was also a top-secret Cold War weapon, where it was designed to be a convertible troop ship able to speed across the sea for 10,000 miles without refueling and able to accommodate an entire division of troops.
Nearly 1,000 feet long and weighing over 53,000 tons, the SS United States was the largest ocean liner ever built. Her top speed, over 38 knots, 44 miles an hour, remained a military secret for decades. Instead of the traditional wood paneling and lush fabrics of traditional ocean liners, Gibbs, obsessed with fire safety, used aluminum, fiberglass, and the asbestos compound Maronite, wonder materials of the post-war world.
The story goes that my grandfather engaged in a pitched battle with Theodore Steinway over whether or not he could design a baby grand piano in aluminum. And finally, after Steinway agreed to douse a mahogany alternative in gasoline and ignite it, and it didn't really erupt into an explosive flame, that my grandfather acquiesced and the mahogany pianos were permitted.
The SS United States embarked on her maiden voyage from New York on July 3, 1952. She raced across the Atlantic in just 3.5 days, smashing the old speed record while using only 2/3 of her power. For 17 years, the Big U was the nation's flagship and a potent propaganda symbol. Everything about her trumpeted America's power and prosperity, especially to immigrant passengers leaving war-torn Europe for the New World. Stephen Ujifusa is writing a book on the SS United States called A Man and His Ship. During his research, he interviewed a refugee from communism who had sailed on the United States.
And he had fled East Germany, you know, basically with the clothes on his back. And he had managed to get a ticket to go over to America on the SS United States. And he said that when he saw those red, white, and blue funnels on the Bremerhaven skyline, that represented freedom to him.
But the Big U's days were numbered when jet flight became commonplace in the 1960s. Unable to justify the ship's expense, the U.S. government retired her in 1970 and eventually sold the vessel. Stephen Ujifusa sees the selling of the ship as the beginning of her downward spiral.
She ended up being stripped of all her furnishings in the mid-80s at a huge auction. And then in the early 90s, she was towed over to Turkey by another owner who stripped out all the Maronite paneling and all the asbestos in preparation for a refit. But then that project didn't work out, so en route back to America, she was repossessed by Cantor, Edward Cantor, who brought the ship to Philadelphia. And that's where she's been ever since.
Beginning in 2004, the SS United States Conservancy began working with the liner's latest owners, Norwegian cruise line Genting Hong Kong, to find ways to repurpose the vessel. But in early 2010, the owners began to accept bids from ship scrappers. The nation's former flagship was on the verge of being melted down for trash cans and paper clips when in July 2010, Philadelphia philanthropist Jerry Lenfest came to the rescue.
I initially said I would provide $300,000 if they gained the rest of the money to keep the ship, and then I enlarged that to $5.8 million grant, $3 million of which would be used to buy the vessel. And the remainder would be to pay for her for insurance and the dockage fees for 20 months, which would give the Conservancy the opportunity to go out and raise the funds to restore the vessel.
Lenfest has a personal connection to the SS United States. His father, a naval architect, designed her watertight doors, and Lenfest himself worked on its construction. He believes that the Big U is worth saving as a symbol of America's post-war prowess.
She was built after the Second World War and represents that great period in the United States when we were the foremost manufacturer, and that ship was the finest ship. She won every speed record in the Atlantic and was worth preserving because I think she represents a high point in the history of the United States.
The Lenfest gift enabled the SS United States Conservancy to take official title to the ship. The Conservancy has unveiled a master plan to make the former liner the centerpiece of a waterfront development which might incorporate a luxury hotel and retail space in addition to parkland and a museum. The group is currently seeking public and private partners in New York, Miami, or Philadelphia to develop what Susan Gibbs envisions as
just this jewel on the waterfront and a, you know, an iconic visual attraction as well as a real money-making entity for the city that gets her. There's certainly a road to climb, but I think the potential is enormous for the ship to really serve a number of different objectives, both historic preservation, but also economic revitalization, job generation, and, you know, it could really do it all.
While the SS United States is safe for now, its future is far from assured. Over the next 20 months, the Conservancy must secure partnerships and raise the money needed to redevelop the ship at an estimated price tag of at least $200 million. That's a lot to accomplish between now and November 1, 2012. Until then, the world's fastest liner will remain at rest on the Delaware waterfront while embarked on a race for her life.
WRTI's Tom Keels. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.